Let's start off in Acts chapter 8 and verse 10. You may remember that we're dealing with Philip. He's gone down to the area of Samaria. There's a specific city that he goes to. That city is not identified. And he's doing some preaching. He's also going to meet up with a fellow by the name of Simon, Simon the sorcerer. The paragraph begins in Acts 8, 9, "But there was a certain man, Simon by name, who before time in the city used sorcery, and amazed the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one." And then verse 10, "To whom they all," that would be the people in this Samaritan city, "to whom they all gave heed, from the least to the greatest, saying, this man is that power of God which is called great." Now, Simon is making himself out to really be somebody. He's saying that he's great. He's doing that on an ongoing basis. The present tense is used. We mentioned last time that he might have made messianic claims. We'll say a little bit more about that later in the class. I also mentioned to you that his assertions, if they were not godlike, they're almost godlike. He may have been saying that he was something like the spark of God himself. So he has really elevated himself. He's making some supreme claims. Maybe he was claiming to be the representative of God, but he is really out there as far as the claims that he's making. Now, when you go back and you look in the first century, this is new material. We didn't touch on this last week. You have magicians like this, and we'll make a distinction between magicians that we have now and the kinds that we find in the Bible like this, and a little bit later in Acts 19. One source said they were common in the Roman Empire in New Testament times. When Emperor Tiberius, especially in the later part of his reign, kept a large number of magicians as advisors in his court. Paul, of course, comes a little bit later into contact with one in Acts chapter 13. Now, as Simon is doing this kind of stuff, what's the response of the people? They... All right, they're amazed, and they also give heed. They're listening to him. You might say that they're hanging on every word. They're giving careful attention to the things that he's doing. And as you look at verse 11, ahead a little bit, how long had they been doing that? They've been doing that for a long time. So this is not something the guy comes into town and he's got a few tricks and people listen to him for a night or a week or a month, but this has been going on for an extended period of time. Giving heed in verse 10 is the same word that's used back in verse 6. Here it's described with the imperfect tense that is continuous action. One source defined that as these people were following Simon. And that's interesting because sometimes people say, well, a certain class, a certain group is following that individual. And maybe they're following because of this or that. But when you look at the people who were following Simon, the Bible says they were from the... Isn't it there in verse 10? Let's go back and see what we read.
Verse 9, where it says the same city. Is that what you're looking for?
Let's look at verse 10.
From the smallest
children. Yes, there we go. To whom they all gave heed from the smallest or the least to the greatest. Now, when you're able to convince that great span of people to listen to you, to follow you, and maybe give you money, you've either got something that's real, or you've got a pretty good bag of tricks, and that's what we think was true for Simon. So all without distinction were giving heed to him. Now, as you look at the people, Luke said that all the people were saying. Once again, that's an important verb. It wasn't that they said, good show came to town and we were really impressed, but all the people were saying, present tense, ongoing action. This man has what? The great power of God. Now, if you are hearing that about yourself, people are saying that, you've got the great power of God. Even for a person who is maybe somewhat modest, what do you think that that's going to do to them eventually? I think that's going to give you a big head. It's going to puff you up. You're the greatest, and you've got the power of God. And if you didn't have that view, you're probably going to develop that view at some point.
Right. King James says this man is the great power of God.
Okay.
Do you have that he has the great power?
Let's take a look at that and see how that...
Okay.
Okay. This man is that great power of God.
He has power from God, and he is the great power.
Yeah, and I think that's consistent with the present tense, that this guy, he's been endowed with that. Either if he's not the spark of God, he's the Messiah, or it's something like God has come down to us. So it's some pretty heady stuff that we're dealing with here. All right, so we've got all the people making this kind of claim and so forth. And as you look at this, one source suggested that Simon may have seen himself, or people may have seen himself, or seen this man as the conduit to God. Do we have something similar to that today? People look at other individuals and they see them as the conduit to God? Well, okay, that wasn't the direction that I was going, but I do think that you would look at Catholicism, for example, and they would sort of see Mary or maybe a saint as the conduit to God. What else?
A lot of people, even denominations and sometimes within the church, people will follow whatever the preacher or the minister is saying or some special teacher they have, mm-hmm. and they think that they don't have to study for themselves.
Sure.
Whatever he says is going
to
be right.
And it's still the least to the greatest because he's, if not God, right next to him. Any other examples or illustrations, Steve?
There's some televangelists. Yeah. Say, he spoke directly to me and I'll...
I've got the power.
Right,
you send me your money and I'm the conduit to God, to financial blessings, health, or whatever you want, long and happy life. And they make that claim either directly or indirectly, and a lot of people believe that. And we'll talk about a little later why some people have that kind of belief. One of the questions that is, you look at Simon, this is really central to the whole account, and I had somebody ask me about this after class last week, and I said, well, we just didn't get quite that far, but it was on the agenda, is where did Simon's power come from? Was it all trickery? Was he a good illusionist? Was he something like a good magician? Or was there actually the occult involved? Was there some involvement with sorcery? We can't say for certain. I'm more inclined to believe that he was a good illusionist. He was really good with trickery. He would have been a great modern magician. I can't say that for certain, though. Thayer, in looking at the verb which is translated sorcery, used in the present tense, found only here in the New Testament, said it meant to be a magician to practice magical arts. The word translated sorceries in verse 11, he says, describe the work of a sorcerer or magician, whether genuine or fraudulent. So I think that's important. The word which is used there in verse 11, it can describe somebody who's actually doing magic tricks or maybe by the power of the occult or something that is fraudulent. As I said, he could have been a great illusionist. We do know, especially as you deal with people outside the U.S. today, you think, for example, countries like India, there are some people who are involved with demonic stuff. Now, whether or not there's actually some power there, that question, I guess, is open to debate. But when you look at people who are involved with astrology, incantation, sorcery, a lot of those things, it's been around for a long, long time. As you go back and you look at some history, you find some things that are probably still around today, but certainly in the past. I'll give you this quote. Curse invocations, that is, you might agitate somebody and they put a curse on you. They put a hex on you. That kind of thing has been going on for a long, long time. But he said curse invocations were central to ancient magic. The source also noted how people used erotic charms. These were supposed to influence sexual behavior, as well as sometimes they would cast spells to cheat in sports. Now, you don't hear about that too often today, at least I don't. But there were ancient spells where people thought if you were going to have a chariot race, for example, you would put a hex on this chariot racer. And the hope would be that his wheels are going to fall off or he's going to crash and burn or somebody else is going to kind of take him out. Now, for us, cheating in sports usually comes down to what?
Drugs.
Yeah, they're probably going to use drugs or they're going to get some kind of mobster to take somebody out. But that's not new as far as cheating in sports. But in the past, people used these charms and spells. Sometimes they were used in a positive way. People might use them for something like childbirth. But again, it's a very, very old practice. Now, taking that, and then we'll deal with this, and then look at verse 11. Somebody says, what about modern magicians? Are they wrong? Are they sinful in the practices? Would it be sinful to go see a magic show? A couple things about that. I've always been interested in magic since about the age of 10. My parents took me to a magic show, and I was really intrigued. About 4 years later, I was in Scouts. And they brought in a young fella to try to clean him up a little bit. He was sort of a ruffian, but the kid was involved with magic, and not bad magic. His parents, maybe they were looking at different things. They tried Scouts, and there was also some kind of magic program in the area where we were. And this kid was gifted. I remember he showed me some pins. They were little gold pins, and they were like a showman, like you'd see in Monopoly. You remember the little showman guy? That's about what they look like to my recollection. And if you got a gold pin, if you were able to do a trick in front of some fellow magicians and they couldn't figure it out. And this kid had multiple pins. I mean, magic was just his gift. And even though he was rough around the edges and who knows what happened to him, he's probably in jail or prison. But anyway, that aside, he was really good when it came to magic. And over the years, I've just kind of kept up with that a little bit and read some things about it. There is a publishing company called Prometheus Books. Now, if you looked up Prometheus books, you'd find two things. Number one, they are very expensive. A single book, I don't have one that would, I don't know, you know, a book like this might cost you $35 or $40. They are very, very costly. You would also find, as you look at Prometheus books, a lot of titles which deal with atheism, skepticism, things which were written to deny that Christianity is true. But as you look at Prometheus books, you'd also find some other things in that same vein of thought that would be sort of on the investigative side of things. There is a fellow by the name of James Randi. Anybody ever hear him? James Randi? Got this. He looks like an Amishman, at least the pictures I've seen. He's got this big old beard, and he's got to be at least in his 60s now, maybe he's 70 plus. But Randi is a world-famous magician. And for a number of years, Randi was carrying around in his wallet a check for $10,000. And he said that he would immediately write that check out to anybody that could show him one verifiable miracle. He's a skeptic. At least at the time that I was following him a bit, he didn't believe in Christianity. Christianity claims to be a supernatural religion. So he said, okay, show me your miracle. A lot of people tried for the check over the years. But Randi, being that first-class magician, he was all, well, okay, you can make the table go up, or you can do this, that, or the other thing. And he said, it's a trick, it's a hoax, and, you know, I know your secret. Now, I gave you all that information to tell you about this little book. This book is almost 40 years old. It came out in 1980. I bought it in 1986. It's called The Fakers. It has a dual authorship, Danny Corum and Paul Meyer. Meyer is a medical doctor and also a psychologist, and Danny is a magician. I want to read you some pages because it relates directly to what we have here in Acts chapter 8 and what I've said thus far. He talks about initially some concern. He didn't want to be involved with anything that would be contrary to Christianity. So he went back and looked at the Greek and Hebrew words to see what was involved as far as magic, to see if the tricks that people today could anyway, in any way be related to those terms, and concluded that there is no association. When you deal with the sorcerers and the other things, it's not just amusement. It is for something that would be tied in with the occult. He says, and I'll start here, magic, as it is commonly used today, denotes a performer who entertains by presenting tricks of sleight of hand or through illusions. The word magician, as we know it today, did not even come into popular use until several hundred years ago. Now let that sink in. Magician, as we think of it, didn't come into popular use until the last few couple hundred years. We used to be called jugglers because of the clever, manipulative ability we could display with our hands. Only in a few rare cases do modern magicians ever claim to have supernatural powers. Those who do are quickly exposed by other members of our trade. A recent example is Uri Geller, the purported psychic who claimed he could bend metal objects with his mind. He was exposed as a fraud by the knowledgeable and talented magician James Randi. So again, that fellow I was telling you about, he pops up again here in the book, in his book, The Magic of Uri Geller. It is possible, however, to convince almost anybody under the right circumstances and through the use of trickery that one may have supernatural powers. Again, let that sink in because I think it has direct relation when it comes to Simon. He says, once again, it's possible to convince people, almost anybody, under the right circumstances and through the use of trickery, that one may have supernatural powers. I made this point clear to several classmates while attending a certain university. I argued that unless one is schooled in how the mind can be deceived, one is at a potential disadvantage when trying to objectively report so-called manifestations of occult powers. To illustrate my point, we went down to the pizza parlor on campus. I asked my friends to pick out someone who was eating by himself, and I would make that person believe I was a visitor from the planet Pluto. Well, he actually did. They chose a fellow sitting in the corner of the restaurant. I bought a pizza and walked over to his table. "Do you mind if I join you?" I asked. "Sure, have a seat," he replied. Some small talk ensued for the next few minutes, and then I said, "I can't find my fork. Look, there it is." As I said this, I reached into the air and by sleight of hand produced the fork from thin air. His eyebrows raised so that they almost touched his receding hairline. "Son of a gun, I forgot my ice water," I said. So I took my napkin and covered my hand with it. When I removed it, presto, the glass of ice water. When I placed it on the table, my newfound friend immediately grabbed it to make sure it was for real. I had also ordered a side order of olives. I took one of the olives in my right hand and placed it in the palm of my left hand. Closing my left hand, I commented on the quality of the olives they served and how much I liked olives. Slowly, I worked my hands back and forth, and when I opened them, all that was left was the pit, At this point, this fellow was becoming profoundly disturbed. "What are you, some sort of magician or something?" he asked. "What are you talking about?" I replied. "All the tricks you've been doing," he responded curiously. "They aren't tricks," I said. "Well, what are they?" he asked. "Oh, you wouldn't believe me if I told you," I answered. As I said this, I pretended to notice some tomato sauce on my napkin. I folded it in half, and when I opened it, the spot was gone. It took a monumental effort to keep myself from rolling over with laughter as I witnessed the expression on his face. Quickly, I changed the subject and temporarily halted the miracles. Finally, after 20 minutes, with his curiosity eating him alive, he relented and asked, "Come on, what were you doing a few minutes ago? I told you you wouldn't believe me." I started as the cat and mouse game continued. "You'd probably laugh and think I was crazy," I added. "Hey, man, look, I'm serious. You've got to tell me what you're doing," he replied in earnest. "Okay. You promise not to tell?" I asked, setting the hook. "No, man, it stays with me," was his eager reply. "I'm from Pluto, and I have my powers beamed down to me," I said, with a straight face that would have rivaled any sculptured statue. "You're kidding," he blurted out. "I told you that you wouldn't believe me," I snapped back. "No, no, no, I believe you. It just sounds so incredible. Can you do something else?" he asked, wanting to believe. I then proceeded to perform from my arsenal of impromptu tricks, seemingly cause objects to levitate, change form, and move invisibly from one place to another. Now think about that. And you can see how, if that's possible today, somebody like Simon could have done that. Those kinds of things. Objects seemingly to levitate, change form, and move invisibly from one place to another. He actually thought that I was from Pluto. And I thought that my friends, who had been quietly observing everything, were going to give it away. To finish the story, the poor fellow avoided me whenever he saw me on campus. It took me 3 months to track him down long enough to tell him I was not from Pluto. Fortunately, he's the only person I've ever tried to hoodwink into believing that I had supernatural powers. Someone else might not have lived through the experience. Now, that's two pages. I want to give you one more. Here's the whole point of the story. Given the proper circumstances, anyone can be made to believe that he has witnessed something which never took place. When I present a trick, the lay public knows it is a trick, and I'm a mere entertainer. This is readily apparent to my audience as I present my stage show, complete with one-liners and anecdotes. Now take me out of that setting and have me try to convince someone that I have powers, and many people will be convinced. In one of my presentations, I perform what are called mentalism tricks. This is where I apparently read someone's mind or predict future events. Even though the audience is told at the outset that this is a trick, there are those who still believe a mystical power is involved. Whether in a concert hall or one-on-one, people can be fooled. Even magicians are susceptible. I can recall discussions where fellow magicians discussed the possibility that Uri Geller's metal and key-bending tricks might be legitimate. That was due to the cleverness of his methods. If magicians can be fooled, how much easier it is to fool the lay public. It is a false notion that a magician is able to fool his audience because the hand is quicker than the eye. For a magician to excel in his craft, he must first fool the mind and then fool the eye. Our craft can be divided into three levels of deception. The first is called the puzzler. This is a trick that fools only the eye. The spectator can, with some thought, uncover the secret of the trick. The next level is called the fooler. With the fooler, the eye has been completely deceived, and so has the mind. A typical example is when the magician produces a live dove from some silk handkerchief. The spectator does not know how the magician produced the dove, but he instinctively knows that it had to come from somewhere. Your mind and your eye have been deceived, but you still know that something had to have happened. The last level of trick is called the baffler. This is what all top-flight magicians strive to present in their programs. And then he gives an example of the baffler. So as you think about those three tricks, Simon may have been doing some of the things that would have fallen into the baffler category, some of the other two as well. But that's just a small taste of what's in that book and gives you some insight as to when you're dealing with a magician who is really, really good. And as I said, I gave you that information about the 14-year-old. There are just some people that are just naturally talented. I've tried some magic tricks over the years, and that's not been my thing. But I gave a sermon illustration a few weeks ago about being out in Colorado. And this fella who was also on the lectureship, he was a magician slash preacher and wanted to, you know, spend some time with me and whatnot. And we go down to a dark place and he shows me some tricks and so forth. And in talking to him, I didn't give this information out in the sermon. In talking to him, he said, if you were to come to my house, you would find that I have tapes and I have videos and I have books. So he is someone, and I think this is probably true of most magicians, they have researched that and they've looked for various tricks. And Simon may have done the same kind of thing, because this stuff was not new. So, again, I can't say that his power was not from the occult, but when you look at it, it seems to me that At least that's possible, and certainly that's probable. Anything that you want to add or ask over that, Bonnie?
Well, verse 9 says that he bewitched the people of Samaria, so it could be like what you were,
like I say, you know,
got them all wrapped up.
Yeah. And when you start thinking, a person comes in and thinks, oh, he can't do anything, and all of a sudden, you know, he makes the olive disappear and so forth, or something on the handkerchief and it disappears, you know, that kind of sets the stage. Tell the person the kind of thing that we had in the book. Oh, I'm from Pluto. And it's, you can disengage the mind in some interesting ways. Anybody else before we look at verse 11, Acts 8? Okay. In that 11th verse, and they gave heed to him, because that of long time he had amazed them with his sorceries. As you look at these people, remember again how many were giving heed to him? The Bible says all from the smallest or the least to the greatest. You have to wonder why these people were not only giving heed to them, but they were listening for how long? A long time. Now, if you watch a magician, that was one of the things that, as I was studying magic a little bit, that I picked up. Never show a person the same trick twice. Anybody want to know why that little rule exists? Now, there might be some really good magicians who would show you the same trick 2, 3, 4, 10 times. But especially if you're a beginning magician, why not show the same trick twice? All right, they start figuring it out. The first time, it's kind of new and wow. But the second time, maybe they're looking here instead of there. So Simon may not have had that problem. But they're looking at him for a long time. Some explanations have been given as far as why he was so successful for a long time. One possibility is gullibility. Would you say that people are gullible?
Yes.
Okay, we've got the Pluto illustration. What else when it comes to gullibility? I had one fellow tell me one time he'd bought the $29.95 hearing aid off TV. How well do you think a hearing aid for $29.95 is going to work off TV?
Not very good.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to work as well as the one that's $4,000 or $5,000. But why would somebody spend $29.95? TV commercials are expensive, aren't they? That's very expensive to have a 30-minute infomercial. So why do you think that people are able to put on a 30-minute infomercial that's really costly?
Because they work.
People are buying the products. But why would somebody buy a hearing aid for $29.95 when they really know that's not going to work? Well, it might be all that they can afford, but still, deep down, what do they hope? There's a little gullibility there.
Family members that did that.
Okay, well... But people hope. They're gullible enough to say, I hope it's going to work. Where else do we see gullibility?
Also, the more you hear something, after a while, you start believing it.
Yeah. Where else do we see gullibility? Trace or Gary?
Scammers, they say they're from a certain agency and they demand payment, or you buy my product and they come to your house and you buy my product and they could rob you or they could sell you something totally not right.
Anybody ever have the person who comes along with the cleaning supplies?
Yeah.
Squirt, squirt, and everything just seems to disappear. Now, I've never bought the bottle, but I suspect that what's in the bottle may not be exactly what they squirted on the house or the driveway or whatever, and it doesn't work quite as well. But people, like I say, they want to believe, and even though they think, well, I'm going to take a chance, is sometimes what you hear. I took a chance, and it didn't work, but gullibility. All right, there's another possibility, and that would be man's desire to believe in someone or something. People look at their own lives and, you know, the lives of others, and they think, well, okay, we can only go so far. So it would be really nice to have what? Someone or something outside of us that can help, offer some kind of assistance. And if you have this guy Simon coming, and he's got all these signs, remember what Jesus said in Mark 16. And these signs shall be what? These signs shall follow them. Why were the signs going to follow them? They confirmed or they proved the word. When people see, isn't that what the infomercials do? The guy gets his $29.95 hearing aid, and what's he say? Well, I can hear the mail truck come now. Or you have somebody else. They have a sign. There is something which confirms the testimony. And if you have Simon coming along and, you know, he's saying, I'm the great power of God, and he's using these signs to apparently confirm his word, And people want someone or something outside themselves that can offer some kind of assistance. It would only be natural to turn to him and hope that he can offer some kind of assistance. When you start thinking about the Old Testament, you remember some of those passages which talk about the other gods? The Old Testament is filled with that. God said to his people time and time again, don't follow other gods. Even when he gave the Ten Commandments, remember? Thou shalt have no other god before me. And that was one of the big things that God specified throughout the Old Testament. Even sometimes, Judges 10:6 would be an example, even when God was dealing with some foreign nations, he made that point that that was a bad, bad thing. But text tells us, like 2 Chronicles chapter 28, 20 through 23, that even rulers sometimes want someone or something that is greater than themselves. So there is that desire to reach out and find someone or something greater. So if it wasn't gullibility, it might have been this. A third possibility, as far as why Simon had so much success in this area and why the success was so long-lasting, might be Jesus. Had Jesus spent some time in the area of Samaria? Yeah. Especially you have the one at the well, you've got some healings with the lepers over there, Luke chapter 17. So Jesus comes in, sort of stirs up some interest. Maybe Simon could have come in and built on that a little bit, especially if he comes in with some miracles. Now it says he was there for a long time. Now think about this a little bit. If you think about Jesus going to the area of Samaria, a couple years later, Jesus is dead. Simon may have shown up not long after that. And he could have been there perhaps for 5, 6, 7 years when you start thinking how much time has passed in the book of Acts and when the Lord was in the area of Samaria. So sometimes people just fall into the right thing at the wrong time. I might be incorrect on this, but I believe this is right, that David Koresh, as you look at what happened there, down there in Texas, there was a woman that was heading up that movement. Koresh shows up at the right time, gets hooked in with her, and ultimately that allows him to start leading the group. He just, in some respects, came in to the right place at the right time. The circumstances just all fell together. And maybe Simon, with some really good tricks, was able to come into this area. If that's true, I think that there's an interesting lesson in there. Can you see what the lesson would be? Yeah. Timing would not only be very important, but also you think the devil is interested in getting in there, and here's what God has done. The devil is interested in coming in there and undoing, perhaps at the ideal time, what God has done. All right, when saying that the people gave heed to Simon, that's the same term that we have used back there in verse 10. We've already talked about that a little bit, but Luke does use the imperfect tense here. So the people are continuing to give heed to Simon and his sorceries or the bewitching that he was doing. When you look at Simon, even if he did have good timing and trying to kind of undo some of the work that the Lord had done, you also have to say that he, in some respects, was helpful to the cause of Christ, wasn't he? Did Simon and his efforts help advance the gospel? Yeah. When people want to, and we can use this, I guess, in this area because of the RVs. If people want to, for example, sell an RV, you're down there at the RV show. How might a sales guy do that? Or you're on the new car lot, or the used car lot, but the new car lot's a better illustration. How does the guy sell you a new car? Yeah, this has this, this, and this compared to this one, which doesn't. In the old days, it might have been this one has the crank windows, this one has the power windows, this one has no AC, this one has AC. Now, that's kind of gone by the wayside as far as buying cars now, but that comparison technique. So when you think about Simon, what happened to the air in his balloon after Philip begins to show up and do these signs? It all kind of fizzles, doesn't it? So Simon sort of sets a precedence. He sets the bar a little bit by showing people, his bag of tricks. And then, Philip comes into the area, and then that would be Philip. He's amazing with people as they see things. The word which is translated bewitched, to give you a little bit of information about that as well, that's in verse 11. That might be a little misleading because when you, well, I'll just throw that out as a question. When you see the word bewitched, what comes to mind?
TV show.
Yeah, that might be one of the first things that comes to mind. Good old Samantha. What else? Bewitched.
Fooling you.
All right, fooling you, trickery. It is the same word which is translated astonished elsewhere in the chapter. So also another translation might use the word amazed. So when you see that word translated bewitched, don't be put off by the word. Astonished, amazed would be good synonyms for it. Now, one of the interesting things about that would be that it is expressed with the perfect tense. What do we know about the perfect tense? Yes, it describes something that happened in the past, and it is continuing as far as the effects. So when it says that Simon bewitched the people, think about that in terms of the perfect tense. Maybe from the very first, from the get-go, he's got them in grip. And then as he continues to show and demonstrate and illustrate his bag of tricks, or if he was involved with the occult, the people continue to believe him. So as one source said, his hold on the people was deep and strong. Now if you're going to get people out of that belief, what's it going to take?
Better signs.
You're going to have better signs. And Philip did have those. There's a lesson there, I think, too. When we think about people today, are they sometimes entrenched deeply when it comes to certain beliefs or practices?
Yes.
Yeah. And if you're going to get them out of the belief or practice, what's going to have to occur?
You have to show them the truth is better.
Well, that could be one angle. You're going to have to show them that these are your beliefs, the truth is better. But let's look at it from a slightly different perspective. Here's a person who says, all my friends are there where I worship. Based on the principle in Acts 8, what's that telling you? Well, let me make it a little clearer. Here's a person who says, all my friends are here. And they come over to a congregation that's teaching the truth. And they get a cold reception. Guess what? They are not going to move. Do you think the truth is probably going to move them? No, because in their mind, what matters most? Their friends. And if they have told you that all my friends are there, before they come to worship, what do you think might be a good practice? Make sure that some members at that congregation know that we have somebody coming in and they're deeply tied, they're deeply rooted to the congregation where they currently are. And truth is obviously important, but that's probably not where they're going to begin. And that may not be where we need to begin. We need to make sure that we cover the friendliness factor because something needs to be stronger than the grip that they're currently in. So that's a helpful lesson. Anybody else want to add a thought? Okay, let's go down and see what else we've got. We've talked about the word bewitched. Let's head over and see what we've got beginning in Acts chapter 8 and verse 12.
Brad.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know where you were going to go there. So, but one other thing about this sorcery and its ability to affect people that we didn't mention was the sophistication of society 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
We could see a comparison today by looking at the native or indigenous people of a place like Borneo or the Amazon jungles or whatever. It's not that the people were not smart. It's not that they weren't intelligent. It's just that the sophistication of society at that point in time wasn't nearly what it is today. And so it's easy enough to see how people can be fooled today. It's much easier to see how they could have been misled and fooled 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, superstition has reigned, and even still does in a lot of places today. But you're exactly right. You go back a couple thousand years, and in some respects, life was simpler. I don't know that this is necessarily a good comparison, but when you think about the Amish in the area, I'd like to think that they are a little simpler when it comes to, you know, their English counterparts, that they take things in a somewhat simpler way, that they're more direct and straightforward and not expecting the trickery. So if you have people, can we say that they have a pure heart in some respects or more childlike? I'm not sure exactly the description that you want to give there, but if you're dealing with people who have not been deceived as much as some others have, then yes, it's probably going to be a good bit easier to go in there and trick them rather than some people who are accustomed to that kind of thing and they're always on the alert for deception. So yeah, I think that would be another reason why Simon may have been so effective.
Well, magic also had a long history, a long period of time to become developed. And if Simon was in any way interested at all, we stop and think about the fact that sorcery was being used in, as far as recorded in the Bible, back in the time of Moses when they were dealing with Pharaoh.
Yeah.
It was well tuned by the time it came to the first century.
I mentioned this in a sermon when we were going through the book of Exodus, that part of it. But one of the things that had always perplexed me was how the magicians in Egypt were able to turn their snakes into staffs. That perplexed me for a number of years. And then I finally figured that out as we were going through that part of Exodus. I found that there's actually a snake that's common in that area. And if you hold it in a particular way, it basically paralyzes the snake and freezes it. So it may not be a staff in the sense that we would normally think of a staff, but I mean, when you're imitating and trying to pretend, that's about as close as you're going to get. And so they were familiar with that. Now, how did they develop that knowledge? Was somebody out there one day, or you know, handling a snake, or was going to boil it for supper and held it, and the snake stiffened up? I don't know exactly how they figured that out, but anyway, they did get that knowledge, and they used that knowledge, and that may not have been widespread knowledge, and some other things. You know, people figure out some interesting things sometimes, and sometimes it's just trickery, and sometimes it's intentional, sometimes not. But yeah, and again, I think a great thought there, Ray.
I think sometimes when I hear a news story, they interrogate indicators more time, or even Elkhart could have somebody sitting there that somebody that they're trying to get to admit their guilt. That is not guilty, but over time they will admit their guilt. If the prosecutor or interrogator keeps that up.
Yeah. And the same thing for trickery. You can come in and I'm great, and people are going to look at them for some kind of sign, but you've already sort of built up enough of a persona that if you can demonstrate a trick or two, people will say, yeah, hey, I did see it. And you may not have to do too much because of all the things that you claim. All right, let's take a look at what we have in Acts chapter 8 and verse 12. I don't think we can get fully through that verse today, but at least we'll go ahead and get started with the time that we have. But when they believed Philip preaching good tidings concerning the kingdom of God in the name of Jesus Christ, they were baptized, both men and women. So thinking about verse 5 of the chapter, Philip has come to the area of Samaria. He's in some town. We're not sure exactly which one it was. And what's he preaching? He's preaching good news, good tidings concerning, he gave the answer, Christ and the name of Christ and the kingdom of God. When you think about a lot of the teaching today, and some of it sadly is in the church, but a lot of it would be in the denominational world, people do a lot of talking, but they don't talk very much about what? Christ, the good news, the gospel, and the kingdom of God. But we have some preaching here. Philip is preaching about Jesus, and that statement alone implies something, doesn't it? He's coming to town talking about Jesus. What would that suggest about his preaching? Let's go tonight and hear a sermon about Jesus. You think you'd hear anything if you were a non-Christian that applied to you in that sermon? You're a non-Christian, going to a tent meeting, hearing some preaching about Jesus. Do you think anything in that message would apply to you?
Yes.
You think you'd hear about sin?
Sure.
I think that would be a central message, wouldn't it? Because Jesus came what? Save sinners, seek and save the lost. Luke chapter 19 and verse 10. So I think that implies that he goes down there and he starts talking about not only the problem with sin, but the solution to it. And then, along with that preaching, what do we have Philip doing?
Signs.
All right, we've got the signs. And we know that from Acts chapter 8 and verse 6. The multitudes gave heed with one accord unto the things that were spoken by Philip when they heard and they saw the signs. That's exactly what Jesus talked about. You're going to go and you're going to confirm the word with the signs which followed. And then in verse 13, we haven't gotten there yet, Simon himself also believed, and being baptized, he continued with Philip, and beholding what? The signs and the great miracles which he wrought. So, okay, I thought there was a thought there. Philip is going and doing exactly what Jesus had told him to do. Now, it seems almost to me that Luke wanted to draw a distinction between Simon and Philip. He's described what Simon was able to do, how he's amazed the people, how he's done that for a long time. He's got his signs, his sorcery, his amazement, his wonders. And now Philip shows up, and he is showing the people that there's something different, much, much stronger. There is also, I think, an implied lesson there. Some people today turn to the occult or turn to trickery because they think there's power there. Where's the greatest power? God and the gospel. So even if a person could access power from the occult, the greatest power is going to come from God. All right, Philip realized that it was necessary to preach good tidings. When you think about the good news, you find here in Acts chapter 8 and verse 12, there is a strong emphasis on the kingdom of God. One source said this, "In every language, a king is a head of state, a sovereign, a monarch. By extension, a head or a representative of a group, one who reigns or presides at an event. A kingdom is the land or state governed by a king, and by extension, a collective or persons or things ruled by a common principle." See that in the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom. Reign is the exercise of royal power, dominion, either absolute or personal. People can understand how this works in the secular realm, but they oftentimes seem to have a problem in the spiritual realm. Jesus, if he's got a kingdom, then he must be a king. And if he's a king, then he's got to be king over his kingdom, whether that's earth or heaven. When you think about the people of Samaria, they should have had at least a somewhat decent foundation for an understanding of God's kingdom. Let's go back for a second to Exodus chapter 19 and see what we've got in verses 3 through 6. We've talked before about how things split apart and the Samaritans came into being, but as the people thought about their history, back here just before you get to the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, you have this statement, or you might say this promise from God. Exodus 19, starting with verse 3 and going down through verse 6. Who has it and would like to read? Gary?
"And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel."
All right. God, just before he gets to the Ten Commandments, talks to the people of Israel, and he talks about a kingdom. And if the Samaritans had thought about biblical history, they only accepted the first five books of the Old Testament, but is Exodus one of the first five? Yeah, it is. So if they were reading that, studying that, kingdom, when he comes to town and starts talking about a kingdom, that should have connected some dots that, hey, okay, this is important. This goes back to the one true God. So let's listen to this guy. When you start thinking about the Old Testament, I'm just going to give you kind of a quick two-minute summarization here. You start thinking about some passages that we should be familiar with. Back there in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God talked about how there was going to be a house established, there was going to be a kingdom established. Before David died, there was going to be some important things that took place. Part of that was fulfilled through Solomon. Part of that was also going to be fulfilled ultimately through Christ. You remember, I think, Isaiah 2 and the information of Micah chapter 4, there was going to be this house, this kingdom. And then Paul comes along in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and says, 1 Timothy 3:15, that men may know how they ought to behave themselves in where? In the house of God. So we do have that house, we do have that kingdom and so forth built by Christ, and that is in place today.